is Jules versus Farinella, 23-1253 and 23-1283. I understand Mr. Farinella will be appearing by Zoom today. So we'll let everybody come up to the podium. And Mr. Jules, you will be beginning. And I'm sure you've been watching, Mr. Jules, how we operate today. You can see we have the little lights in front of you. The clock is initially set to 4 minutes because we understand you would like to reserve a minute for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that means the order will proceed and you'll talk for 4 minutes. Then we will hear from Mr. Farinella by Zoom for 4 minutes. Then we will turn to the appellees who will be at the podium. And then it will be your turn to come back up to the podium for a minute. And if there's anything you've heard from the other speakers that you'd like to respond to, that would be your time to add something. Does that make sense?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so Mr. Jules, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Adrian Jules, appearing pro se. I thank the court for this opportunity. This case turns on a fundamental principle. Only a party to an arbitration agreement may confirm an award under the Federal Arbitration Act. That's not discretionary, it's jurisdictional. Yet in this case, the district court confirmed an award for a party that was never formally before it, Chateau Holdings LTD. Under 9 U.S. Code Section 9, only a party to an arbitration agreement may apply to confirm award. The Supreme Court made this clear in Hall Street v. Mattel, where it held that FAA procedures are exclusive, courts cannot expand or overlook them. In Badgerow v. Walters, the court reaffirmed that federal courts lack authority under the FAA unless jurisdiction exists independently and properly, and that jurisdiction cannot retroactively be fixed. This court in Trina Solar v. Jasmine Solar held that non-signatories cannot confirm arbitration awards even if they were indirectly involved. Here, the arbitration was between myself and Chateau Holdings LTD, but for nearly 4 years, Andre Belisle Properties and its affiliates acted as if they were the employer. They compelled arbitration, moved to confirm the award, and ultimately obtain judgment without ever naming or joining Chateau Holdings LTD as a party. Their March 24th, 2023 motion to confirm names only Andre Belisle Properties and his co-defendants. Chateau Holdings LTD is not in the caption. There was no service, no appearance, no motion to join, and no court order. Only after I filed my appellate brief did opposing counsel admit in writing Chateau Holdings is not listed as an appellee on the docket. We intend to correct that. That's not a typo. It's a jurisdictional failure. Four attorneys from two national firms litigated this case for years and never formally named the only party entitled to enforce the award. That's not a clerical oversight. It's a structural defect. They may argue Chateau Holdings LTD was always the intended party, but intent doesn't create jurisdiction. Under Hall Street and Badgerow, standing must be formal. And Trina Solar confirms that non-parties, even if involved, cannot confirm an award. They may also argue there was no harm, but I litigated against the wrong party. That's real prejudice. Had Chateau Holdings LTD been properly named, I could have objected to standing, raised procedural defenses, and pursued remedies I was denied. Instead, I was locked into litigation with parties who had no formal connection to the agreement, unable to pursue defenses tailored to the real party, and ultimately, that led to an enforceable judgment by someone with no standing to obtain it. This isn't prejudice, it's a constitutional failure. That's not harmless, it's due process denied. Opposing counsel has now filed a motion to intervene after judgment, but Badgerow is clear. You cannot fix jurisdiction retroactively. The FAA doesn't allow it, and Hall Street, Badgerow, and Trina Solar don't allow it either. So I respectfully ask this court to vacate the district court's judgment, deny the motion to intervene, and reaffirm the FAA's jurisdictional limits as clearly laid out in binding precedent. The law is clear. The error is structural. The remedy is reversal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Farinella, why don't we just test our microphones to make sure we can all hear each other?
Good morning, Your Honors.
Great.
Yeah, we can hear you.
We can hear you, so please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Thomas Farinella, the interested party in this matter. I would first like to point out that in Mr. Jewell's papers, going through the research last night and shepherdizing cases, it appears that there was a case that just came down, Smart Ski Networks LLC versus DAG Wireless LTD, which failed to follow the district court's determination in the underlying matter with regard to subject matter jurisdiction. And so the court said that the district court summarily concluded that it had jurisdiction to confirm the arbitration award because the district court's jurisdiction to stay in action pursuant to 9 U.S.C. 3 retained jurisdiction to confirm resulting arbitral awards. The Jules court cited to Cortez 529 U.S. at 202 to support its holding that it had subject matter jurisdiction and expressly found that Badgero did not apply. We decline to adopt the reasoning of the Jules court because, as discussed, we are of the view that its reliance on Cortez is misplaced. Badgero is applicable even when a case was previously stayed pursuant to Section 3.
How clear is Badgero in terms of what was our previous holdings? That is to say, we are bound to follow our previous holdings unless the Supreme Court clearly gets rid of them. So my question is, it's a very interesting split among the circuits about what happens after Badgero in theirs, but isn't the law of our circuit clear and stands unless Badgero directly reverses us?
Judge Calabresi, if I may, thank you for the question. The district court in its order specifically stated that the Second Circuit had not ruled on the issue. So I think that this issue is clear for interpretation by this court.
But I guess, is that really correct? I mean, I thought we really did decide this in Smeag, you know? And I understand if the Fourth Circuit disagrees with us, I mean, that's fine. We don't always agree, but I guess I'm not really seeing how this panel today has all that much leeway in light of Smeag, you know? I mean, maybe if we go on bonk or something, maybe, but...
Well, I still think, Your Honor, that an argument can be made that this court should follow the Fourth Circuit, its sister court, in determining that the district court did not properly have subject matter jurisdiction as it cited its authority for subject matter jurisdiction.
So this may be a rough summary, but are you essentially arguing that Badgero functionally overruled Smeag? I think that has to be your argument, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that the district court misconstrued Badgero as the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals stated in their decision in Smartski Networks LLC versus DAG Wireless LTD.
Okay.
And that was decided February 13th, 2024.
Okay. Good. All right. Well, thank you very much for your argument. We appreciate it. Did you want to add? You have 27 seconds.
I'll do this real quick. I think that one of the most novel issues in this case is that the arbitrator inextricably intertwined the attorney and his client. And I think that when an arbitrator does this, the attorney and their client created an explicit conflict with the rules governing attorneys and their relationship with their clients. The arbitrator pitted the plaintiff and his counsel against each other, which violated identifiable public policy. It gave an unfair advantage to the respondents, and it set off a course where the only real means for resolution was settlement. And so if the plaintiff did not want to settle, the attorney was bound by it.
Okay. You've reserved a minute. Why don't we talk to the appellee, counsel for the appellee, and that's Attorney Morton.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Alexander Morton from Pillsbury on behalf of appellees. And I'll limit my argument, at least initially, unless Your Honors have additional questions for me, to the arguments raised by Mr. Jewels and Mr. Farinella. So first, Mr. Jewels asserts that he litigated against the incorrect parties through the duration of the district court proceedings and into the arbitration as well. And I will note that that was initially by Mr. Jules' own design. He was the plaintiff in this matter. He chose the parties to name in his lawsuit in an apparent attempt to avoid the arbitration agreement that he had with his employer, the Chateau Marmont. He named persons and entities other than the Chateau Marmont with his employment-related claims. And this comes after he filed a charge of discrimination, naming only the Chateau Marmont. It came after his attorney, Mr. Farinella, sent a demand letter, and it came after he was informed that any dispute he would have to be arbitrated pursuant to his arbitration agreement. So it was an intentional decision to try to avoid arbitration. And the district court correctly held that he was required to arbitrate his claims against Mr. Balazs and the related entities under the doctrine of equitable estoppel. They were beneficiaries to the arbitration agreement because the agreement covered all of the claims that he asserted in the lawsuit, and there was a sufficient relationship between those third parties to the agreement and the Chateau Marmont.
But shouldn't the court have required the parties to join? I mean, it may not be necessary, but wouldn't that have been the appropriate procedure?
So at the outset of the litigation, Your Honor, as the plaintiff to the lawsuit, he can name the parties that he seeks to file claims against. And as third-party beneficiaries to the arbitration agreement, these third parties, the named defendants, were entitled to move to compel arbitration. Once arbitration was initiated, that is when Mr. Jules and Mr. Farinella agreed to dismiss the other named defendants and substitute in the Chateau Marmont, Chateau Holdings Limited, as the only named respondent in their arbitration. Once the arbitral award was issued and we went back to the district court to confirm the award, the district court permitted the Chateau Marmont to join in that motion to confirm. And while the Chateau Marmont never moved to join the party, join the action as a named party, it was a movement in that motion. And Mr. Farinella and Mr. Jules never raised any issue with that. They never said that that was improper. They never contested it. They made all the arguments that they would have made had it been formally named as a party. So they can't establish any prejudice to them. So to the extent there was any error, it was harmless. They haven't established that they would have made any argument against the Chateau Marmont joining as a party, or that they would have changed their approach, their strategy, their arguments in any way. On the jurisdictional issue, again, Mr. Jules chose to name these non-parties and to file in non-parties to the arbitration agreement and to file in the Southern District of New York. There was subject matter jurisdiction under both diversity jurisdiction and federal question jurisdiction. There is no dispute that the district court had jurisdiction over the parties.
The place of employment was Los Angeles?
Correct, Your Honor. And again, it was Mr. Jules' choice to file in the Southern District, New York. And that is where his attorney, Mr. Farinella, is located as well. And so there's no dispute that the court had jurisdiction at the time the lawsuit was initiated. There's no dispute that the court had jurisdiction at the time that it stayed the case pending arbitration pursuant to 9 U.S.C. Section 3. There's no dispute that the court had jurisdiction at the time that Mr. Jules returned to it in an attempt to lift the stay of litigation. And so there should be no dispute that the district court had jurisdiction at the time that the appellees moved to confirm the arbitration award. And that comes from Cortez. The Supreme Court is very clear in saying that the court that has authority to issue the stay under Section 3 also has the authority to confirm the award. So Mr. Jules and Mr. Farinella did not address the merits of the motion to confirm, whether there was any basis to vacate under Section 10. I'm happy to address that if your honors have any questions. Otherwise, appellees are prepared to submit.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. So Mr. Jules, if there's anything you've heard it and you would like to respond to, you have a minute.
Yes, Your Honor, pertaining to the named parties on the complaint, there was considerable back and forth in arbitration spearheaded by opposing counsel regarding who could be named.
Did you sue in New New York an attempt to in an attempt to avoid the obligation you had under the under California law to arbitrate?
No, Your Honor. What?
Well, where were you? You resided where?
Currently, I'm in Atlanta. I reside in Atlanta, but I was residing in L.A. when I filed. It was
residing. You were
currently,
residing in
I
LA
was. I was in Los Angeles. Correct, Your Honor.
When you sued in New York.
Yes, Your Honor. That was done because the entire staff had been let go due to the pandemic, and opposing counsel indicated that everybody involved was a third party to the case, and I couldn't depose or speak to them, and I had claims against Andre Balazs, who's a New York resident, which is why I sued in New York and not Los Angeles. I had access to no witnesses. The people that did the wrongdoing, I had zero access to them, which is why I filed in New York. And as it pertains to the name, parties, et cetera, this is the dispute resolution agreement that I signed. And it says, I hereby agree that any claims, disputes, or controversies arising between me and Chateau Holdings LTD, the company. This is what this says. So as it pertains to anything opposing counsel has said, I signed this agreement, I was bound by this agreement, and they didn't list them in their award confirmation. So if they're not listed, what am I to do?
Okay, I think we understand your argument. Mr. Jules, thank you very much. Why don't we hear from Mr. Farinella, last but not least. Mr. Farinella, you have 1 minute of rebuttal if there's any last thing that you would like to add.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I would simply just add to the jurisdictional issue that the arbitration award also calls for enforcement of judgment in Los Angeles. So I think that also goes to the analysis in which the Fourth Circuit observed and concluded that that jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, was not established in the case that they had decided. The other thing that I think is profound in this matter is that the arbitrator was not entitled to issue taxes and costs in this case, and in the unusual and rare move, he chose to take a punitive measure to punish, and the New York Appellate Division case that I cited talks about this violation of public policy when the arbitrator seeks to basically implement the brand of justice, his own sort of brand of justice, was issuing essentially punitive damages.
Didn't the arbitration agreement specifically give him permission to do that?
Whether
he did it right is another matter, but
I don't. I don't believe it did, Your Honor. He was not. The agreement specifically said the tax and costs could not be part of the arbitration, and he originally framed his tax and his punitive damages as tax and costs, and then sua sponte, without any ability to respond to it, changed his tune because he realized that the tax and costs were in contravention to JAMS rules.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Farinella. Thank you to all of you. As with all of the other cases we heard today, we will take it under advisement. There will be a written ruling that will come forth at a certain point.